From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is a big day for Brexit in the UK, maybe the defining day. After more than 2 years of political upheaval, members of the British Parliament will vote on Prime Minister Theresa May's divorce deal with the European Union. And joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, what is the sense about what is going to happen in this vote, which is to take place about an hour from now?
I think the sense is that Theresa May and her deal are going to get a thumping of historic proportions. I mean, the BBC and others think that she could well face a bigger defeat than any government has experienced since 1924. So it's going to be nasty for her.
What is the biggest objection to her plan at this point? Or are there just people coming from all angles saying they don't like it?
It's a bit of the latter, but I guess the main problem she has is with the very kind of anti-EU wing of her own governing Conservative Party, who they just sort of feel that her deal, her plan, could just leave Britain way too close to the European Union, and all of the opposition parties are raged against her for the opposite reason, that the deal, as they would see it, is far too vague. And, of course, those on the pro-European wing of her governing Conservative Party don't like it either, because they think, well, in the end, it just doesn't look as good as staying a member of the European Union.
Is the opposition at all united about what to do if, as expected, Parliament votes against this plan?
Thank goodness. At last, Jeremy, an easy question. No, no, absolutely not. I mean, I guess the way I would put it is that the reason why Britain is in the most almighty political crisis since the end of the Second World War is that its politicians can't decide what to do, can't agree on what to do about the results of the referendum. I mean, it's as simple and as complicated as that. And this is a crisis that doesn't distinguish. It's an all party crisis. So these fractures, these disagreements about what to do about the referendum and what Britain's future relationship with the European Union should be, they apply to both the governing Conservative Party, but also to the opposition Labour Party as well.
So walk us through what's going to happen. How does this vote work? Or series of votes work today in Parliament?
Well, there could be as many as 5 votes, and the whole thing, because this is Britain and we don't do things in an easy way with things like buttons or a show of hands, is immensely complicated. The whole vote could take over, the process could take over an hour. But essentially, at the end of it, if Theresa May loses, which we all expect, I think it's likely that she will then make a brief statement to Parliament, probably not giving too much away. And then we will find out, does she have a plan B? What would the mood of Parliament be? I mean, my hunch would be that she would want to try and carry on, to maybe go back to Brussels, see if she could slightly improve the deal, put it to MPs again, and see if when the clock was ticking down further towards Brexit, they'd be panicked into supporting it. I think we'll also find out, you asked about, is there a united opposition to her? We might find out whether Parliament could take back control of the process and come up with an alternative to Theresa May's plan, such as a softer Brexit, mm-hmm. or perhaps a second referendum. But I think the one thing we can say is that it is profoundly unpredictable, because we are in a genuine crisis. This isn't something, you know, a little bit of trouble about how on earth to regulate dangerous dogs. I mean, this is big stuff.
Now, explain this to me. After David Cameron had campaigned against Brexit and then they had the referendum, he resigned immediately. But you're saying that if Theresa May loses this vote, which she's been campaigning for, that she could stick around?
She may well do, and I think that would certainly be her instinct. But you're right, Jeremy, to highlight this idea that we are not in normal times. I mean, if in any other time, if a British Prime Minister was to lose a vote, I mean more than just 1 or 2 votes, on the absolute key plank of their government's programme, they would be out on their ear. That would be it. Bye-bye. Don't turn round. Off you go. But these are not normal times, and the Conservative Party couldn't necessarily agree on another leader. And I'm not sure that the country, whether there would be another general election, and I'm not sure that Jeremy Corbyn would have much more success negotiating Britain's way out of the European Union than Mrs. May.
One more thing, Rob. When we were there in London during the last big spike in activity over Brexit, I remember watching you on TV, the local BBC channel, and seeing you out there in front of Westminster. And there were protesters behind you yelling and holding up signs and things like that.
What is the atmosphere?
What's the atmosphere there today?
It's like a zoo. You know, when you were here, I remember it, Jeremy, when you were here last time, things were positively calm compared to now.
Wow.
I mean, it reminds me of some of those scenes I've read about in books where they had a kind of a medieval hanging somewhere in Europe where, you know, everyone's kind of banging drums and whistles and waving and no doubt a few drinks as well, all for some sort of horrible, grim spectacle at the end. And really, that's what it feels like. It's a sort of a grim carnival of disunity.
That is the BBC's Rob Watson on a very big day in London. We'll be checking back in with you, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And now let's see what's been reaction to the rare step Republicans took last night of punishing their fellow Congressman Steve King by removing him from committee seats after he asked in a New York Times interview how white nationalist, white supremacist Western civilization became offensive. White supremacists, of course, believe white should be supreme. That thinking has led to things like the Holocaust. King has made comments like, Mexicans are dirt. We can't build a country with other people's babies, meaning immigrants. He's met with a neo-Nazi Austrian group. He's retweeted Holocaust deniers since he began representing Iowa's 4th District in 2003. Today, we called into Open Line with Charlie Stone, a popular conservative show in Sioux City, to see how King's constituents were reacting.
And you are the host of Now and Then, a midday show.
That's so funny.
On the network.
Wait, Charlie, that's so funny because it's here and now. But I'm
sure, here and now.
I'm sure some of our listeners think it's Now and Then sometimes.
Hang on a minute.
I got a job.
Yeah, give him a dough.
That's great. Well, once we got going, host Charlie Stone said he's also been accused of being racist. It's part of the cultural divide.
Here in the Midwest, we don't want to hear what you're selling. We want to believe in what you're saying.
Hmm.
And that might be some rough speech. Hmm. Then that's what it is. Now, I do know that when you have rough speech and do those things, there is a tendency from somebody who has a different set of optics to hear it and go, whoa, what did you just say?
Hmm.
And, you know, I've been called a racist. I'm not a racist, but I've been called a racist.
Well, let me throw something else out. I want to hear the listeners. But when I hear somebody say, we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, I'd like to see an America that's just so homogenous we look all the same. That's what people said about Italians, about people from Poland, you know, about people from Germany, post-war, Japan. You know, that's what I hear.
I hear you.
Okay.
I hear you.
We've been listening to Charlie Stone's show the last couple of days. Some listeners have called to say Congressman King's recent words were the last straw. Here's what we heard today.
Yes, Steve King has stuck his foot in his mouth many times, but we would rather have Steve King, warts and all, than a silver-tongued tyrant that speaks so eloquently, but yet behind the scenes does things that absolutely tear down our country and our culture. I think what Steve's point is that there has to be a common culture of Western civilization, otherwise this country will go down. And I will finish by saying, what we don't like, Robin, bless your heart, we do not like the liberal New England media of New York Times or Boston Globe and those house organs of the progressives trying to tell us out here in common sense land how we should think or act.
I hear you. Let's get another call. I want to hear your opinions.
Yeah, here we go. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Charlie. Yes, Robin, quick question. Mm-hmm. Why am I labeled a racist if I'm against illegal immigration and I want to protect the borders of the United States? We hear it over and over. If you're for the wall, you're racist against someone that wants to break our laws, and I deny that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I think when it comes to Steve King, I think it's so much broader than that. You know, it's comments that he's made about why is white supremacist a pejorative.
There's another caravan forming, I hear, today,
yeah,
because for seeking asylum, knowing that as long as they get to the United States, they're going to get a court date and never show up.
Well,
that's
I'm not here to debate, but I just want to throw out what you just said about people not showing up. Again, statistically, it's very few who don't show up for the court dates, but I hear you.
All righty. Thank you. Let's go over here to Steve.
Hey, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm good.
A lot of us understand that Steve, while he's a good placeholder and whatnot, hasn't got much out of committee. And so to say that, oh, heaven forbid, Kevin McCarthy, take him off the committee, he wasn't really doing much there in the first place besides holding the seat.
Okay.
But the second sentence he said about Western civilization, I guess I could understand the context from what he's saying. Why did we sit in these classes of Western civilization classes? Why did we sit in those classes just to have it be offensive later on and where we couldn't talk about it? If that's what his context was, I can understand where he's coming from. But at the same time, Steve King can kind of be a pain in the rear sometimes for some of us here in Iowa, too. So, anyway, that's some people's opinion, not all.
Right.
I don't speak for everybody by any means.
Nope.
But, yeah.
Well,
anyhow,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Robin.
A sampling of callers on Open Line with Charlie Stone on KSJC, Sioux City, Iowa, Congressman Steve King's district. People also felt Somali refugees in town weren't assimilating, that President Trump wasn't getting punished for crass things he said. We thank Charlie and his callers, and we appreciate the invitation to do it again. New Orleans is set to become the country's first major city with an all-charter school system after the school board moved in late December to give control of McDonough 35 Senior High to the local charter group Inspire NOLA, along with the closure of two other schools directly controlled by the school board at the end of the academic year. This will mark a controversial milestone in one of the country's biggest experiments in education, an all-charter district. We're going to get two different opinions. First, Gertrude Ivory, president of McDonough 35's alumni group, and Yvette Alexis, the group's vice president. Yvette, Gertrude, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And first, let's do a definition for people who kind of have a fuzzy awareness of charter schools. They started in the 1990s. These are independently operated public schools. They can be started by parents or teachers or organizations, for-profit company. They do get tax dollars. They can come up with private funding. They don't charge tuition. They're not like a private school. They must have open enrollment policies. They have to participate in state testing and all of that. You were among the dozens of people who attended that school board meeting in December to speak out against making McDonough 35 a charter. Gertrude, start with you. Why?
For one thing, McDonough 35 is the oldest high school in New Orleans for African-American students. We thought that the school system should steward the success of that high school and not give it away to a charter management organization. There is no proof that this charter system is working. In fact, most of the schools are not doing well.
Well, and that's what many others say. However, proponents say there have been good results. An analysis from the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans, that's led by a Tulane University economics professor, Doug Harris, they find that test scores, high school graduation rates, college outcomes all improved for students who attend in school in New Orleans post-Katrina, which is when much of this, you know, when the school system was turned over to a charter system. Things seem to be doing better.
Well, that's their research, but it's research based on their opinion. Because we have to take into certain matters. We have to look at the fact that we're dealing with a much smaller number of students than we had pre-Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And because things like the benefits of the teachers, the retirement system of the teachers, and the number of experienced teachers with higher salaries decreased, there was additional money available per student. Mm-hmm. So these results could have happened in spite of a charter management group.
Yeah, even if the management group hadn't come in. Look, to remind people, the state of Louisiana took over the school system in 2005 after Katrina, closing almost every school. They brought in these private operators, charter schools, to run things with oversight from a locally elected school board. Yvette, your thoughts, because, look, we're hearing from Gertrude the concern that, you know, the school, McDonough 35, won't be shepherded. But it did have we understand, a D rating. It was not doing well. Isn't it worth trying what the rest of the city is trying?
Well, it wasn't doing well because the school board and the structure that was in place wasn't supporting the school. You can take a great school and not do anything with it, not put any resources into it, and there's a good chance that the school will not do well. And that's what happened. We just had a lot of turnover, a lot of resources that were earmarked for the school were not provided to the school and the students. So it didn't just happen.
You've said resources were pulled, vacancies weren't filled. it wasn't cared for.
That's right. Correct.
Right. Well, again, if the school system isn't doing that, you know, maybe a charter will.
And that's a maybe.
Yeah. We are going to help the charter organization make McDonough 35 be successful. You know, there's no doubt about that. However, the school system relinquished its responsibility and did not do what it needed to do to support McDonough 35 High School. They should not be let off the hook.
What does it boil down to you? It sounds like it boils down to you want it to be a closed circle. Taxpayer money, people who are either elected or have jobs that you know and they come from the community and they have children in the system. You don't want this to be somebody from outside of the town, somebody who may be looking at the bottom line, able to bring in private dollars, and may not care as much about closing a school. That seems to be your biggest concern.
You've gotten a lot of the marks, and that sense of community is really important. I think New Orleans is unique. When you ask someone who's a native where they go to school, they're not going to answer their college. Here, it means your high school. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal, and I know it's strange, but that's just common whether you went to Catholic or private school here in New Orleans. And we've watched a lot of that history be thrown aside. Mm.
That's Yvette Alexis. She is vice president of the McDonough 35 Alumni Association, along with Gertrude Ivory, president of the group. Gertrude, Yvette, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's get another perspective now from Jamar McNeely. He's CEO and co-founder of Inspire NOLA, the charter school group awarded the opportunity to run the new charter at McDonough 35. Jamar, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get right in, address some of the concerns that we're just hearing and have heard from other parents and teachers, that you are outsourcing their kids' education and that you have no incentive to stay your company if things don't go well. Address those concerns.
Well, I think it's totally false in that scenario. One thing about my organization, and we don't see ourselves as a company. We see ourselves as an organization that's educating the students in New Orleans because we are a nonprofit. I am a citizen of New Orleans. I'm one who actually was an educator before Katrina and actually returned to rebuild our city after Katrina to make sure our students had quality schools that they can actually go to. So for me, I have a vested interest, just like my staff, to make sure all students of New Orleans get a quality education so they can be positive citizens in our city. It's unfortunate that when you look at our high schools, we have less than 38% of our high schools with an AB letter grade, that we currently, as an organization, have two of the highest performing high schools that are open admission. We felt like we had to be involved in this historical high school, but not only just be involved in a historical high school, make sure more students in New Orleans had the opportunity to go to a quality high school, most importantly.
Gertrude Ivory and Yvette Alexis, again of the McDonough 35 Alumni Association, say it isn't your charter system that we can thank for the higher test scores and graduation rates since the school system went over to charters. It's the fact that so many students left, and finally there was a big jump in per student spending. They don't give the charter the credit.
Well, even before Katrina, we had some schools that were actually performing with the per pupil that was actually allocated. That allocation has not increased significantly over these last past years. I do believe that we did bring in some great strategies and techniques to make sure our students had the opportunity to learn. I'm not here to speak for the entire system. I am here to speak for Inspire NOLA. And I can tell you that Inspire NOLA, I think, has made significant change. Even in the turnaround schools that we're doing, we're actually taking ELF schools and making those ELF schools be on the top tier in our schools in New Orleans based on the strategies and the techniques that we bring in for our students.
Well, the concern of the outsourcing, you know, the point of people who are against the charter schools is let the local taxpayer dollars pay for it. It sort of anchors it more to the community. People have more skin in the game. People feel like it's their investment in their schools. Where does your funding come from?
Well, our funding comes from the state, local taxes as well as we do get some philanthropy in based on our fundraising efforts to impact our students. We are an organization that try to spend every dollar as possible to impact our students in our schools. There's nothing outside that we're actually doing to have any type of negative connotation towards the work that we're doing for our students. But the majority of our funding come from federal, state taxes, as well as local taxes, as well as philanthropy.
You say majority. So what's the split, local taxes and philanthropy and outside the state philanthropy?
I'm not sure right now if I had to do a percentage-wise on exactly what that split would be, dollar for dollar, but that's majority where our funding is coming from.
Well, you know why that's important to people? Because let's just talk about the elephant in the room. There is a whiff around charter schools of a notion of sort of a white patriarchal takeover of black inner city schools. And in this case, an inner city school that was the first public high school for black children in Louisiana, founded in 1917. So there's a fear of losing that care of the specialness of this school. It sounds to me like you would have that same feeling towards that school. You've already said you're not an outsider, and you're not white.
You got me there on both cases. I'm not an outsider, and I'm not white. Two points that you're raising that I definitely want to address. The first one, dealing with McDonough 35. We're lucky to be an African-American organization that's taken over the school, that's working with the alumni association to make sure that we sustain every legacy proponent of the school. So we're talking to them now to make sure anything that's important, anything that is historical with McDonough 35, that we're sustaining that legacy for McDonough 35. Secondly, when you look at the national landscape, that is actually fact what you're saying about too often we have too few leaders of color given the opportunity to actually run charters in historically African-American communities. I think that's something society and as a whole we have to look and address. Mm. It's also important that we do look at the locals who have the bandwidth and the talent and the skills to start schools, to give them the opportunities as well before we bring in outside organizations. It's important that we have organizations within the community who also understand the fabric of the community and willing to work with the community.
Jamora McNeely, CEO and co-founder of the Charter School Group, Inspire NOLA, New Orleans. Jamora, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
If your next package from Amazon comes with a small bonus, don't be surprised. The online retailer is teaming up with some advertisers to deliver free samples to certain customers based on their purchasing histories. And Amazon's not the only retailer trying to get more innovative with data mining. Walgreens is testing digital cooler doors with cameras to tailor ads to customers in the store. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us to talk about this. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with how this Amazon free sample thing works.
Amazon ships billions of boxes a year, and what they're doing is they're sort of opening the packages up to advertisers with a new service for them. So in certain categories like grocery products, pet foods, beauty products, they're giving brands the opportunity to send free samples to customers who might be likely to buy those products in the future.
How do they pick which customers get what?
Well, they combine consumer browsing and purchasing history with artificial intelligence and basically try to predict who would be receptive to these products. Amazon on its website says that it surprises select customers with samples that we think will be delightful and helpful, which is a pretty low bar.
So likely then if you're ordering, let's say, something for your dog, you might get something else for your dog.
Exactly. So they'll match the products up with consumer behavior.
Now, we talked last month about Amazon's growing advertising business. It's now number 3 in digital ad sales behind Facebook and Google. How do these free samples fit into that larger strategy?
Well, it's offering something that Facebook and Google can't offer, which is a direct product pipeline into people's homes. So this is something that marketers will find appealing because free samples work. They've always worked. Consumers might not be as pleased. There are certainly data privacy concerns.
Right.
And also, users have to opt out of the free samples.
But you can opt out if you want to opt out.
You can. You can go to Amazon's website and opt out of the free samples.
Right.
You can opt out of the data collection.
Who is going to opt out of a free sample? Anyway, there's no opting out of the other story we want to talk to you about, and that's Walgreens. What are they testing here?
So they're experimenting with what are called smart coolers. And these have cameras, they have face recognition technology, they have sensors. And basically what they do is they try to figure out your approximate age, your gender. They can see what's in your cart already.
These are the coolers in the store, the refrigerators.
Right, where there's beer and soda and that kind of thing. And so what they do is they try to assess the consumer. They use that data to tailor ads that will appear on the face of the cooler doors that are targeted to you. They add in the time of day, the weather, whatever it might be. These are ads that are very much customized for the customer in the store.
Not entirely new technology, but this company that's offering it, Chicago-based Cooler Screens, has tailored it specifically for this kind of use.
Right. So these doors are consumer research and billboards at the same time, and they're right there at the point of purchase. So this is something that that has a lot of appeal, according to the Wall Street Journal. About 15 large marketers have signed up for this test that's happening in Chicago and will probably roll out soon to Seattle, New York, San Francisco.
Privacy concerns on this one, I assume?
Absolutely privacy concerns. But the company says basically the data is anonymized, that they don't transmit or save any particular identifying information about people. And Walgreens, the test in Chicago, they have a staffer there to answer questions that consumers might have, customers might have, which I'm sure there'll be many of.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst. We'll have a link to his blog at hereandnow.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
A Chinese military official is warning the U.S. Navy today not to interfere in support of Taiwan's independence. The comment came during a meeting in Beijing with the U.S. Chief of Naval Operations, and it's after a speech earlier this month by China's President Xi Jinping. He said mainland China and Taiwan must unify, and he didn't rule out the use of force to make that happen. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen responded with tough language of her own, marking a low point in the state of China-Taiwan relations. Bonnie Glazer is director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Xi's comments got a lot of attention, but what is he saying exactly? Is he actually threatening use of military force?
Well, it's long been China's position to leave the option of using force against Taiwan on the table. But actually, Xi Jinping's message was one that emphasized peaceful reunification. He was conveying that China is determined to unify Taiwan with mainland China, but he actually wasn't banging the war drums in any way. He was really talking more about the strategy over time to win the hearts and minds of the people of Taiwan.
Well, what was the reaction from Taiwan, though, to this trying to win the hearts and minds strategy?
Well, Taiwan reacted very negatively, in part because Xi Jinping repeated this offer of one country, two systems, which was originally designed for Taiwan but is implemented in Hong Kong. And we've seen such an erosion of freedoms in Hong Kong that it's really not surprising that the people reacted in a way that was quite negative. One survey that was done after Xi Jinping's speech found that about 80% of the Taiwanese people disapprove of this formula as applied to Taiwan.
They don't trust Xi when he says one country, two systems.
No, the people of Taiwan, I think, really jealously guard their freedoms and their democracy. They want to have good economic ties with mainland China. They want to be able to travel back and forth. But they generally see themselves as living in a separate country. There's a small percentage of people that want reunification, really about 3% that want reunification immediately, and maybe about 15% that would like reunification. Reunification eventually. Most people just want the status quo, and there's still about on the other end of the spectrum, about 18% that eventually want independence.
Well, Taiwan has self-governance, but never formally declared independence from mainland China. China, as you say, has long called for reunification. But why do you think the rhetoric seems to be stepping up now?
Well, I think, first of all, is Xi Jinping's first speech that he's given on Taiwan, even though he became general secretary of the party in 2012, and he hasn't looked for an occasion to give a speech. This was the 40th anniversary of what's called the Message to Taiwan Compatriots, when Deng Xiaoping changed from the policy of liberating Taiwan, likely through force, to this new approach of peaceful reunification. And so he was almost obligated to say something on this anniversary, and he decided to give a very comprehensive speech.
What is at stake for the U.S. in all of this?
Well, the United States has very strong abiding interests in the maintenance of peace and stability across the strait. And we have seen Beijing step up military pressure, diplomatic pressure, stolen a lot of Taiwan's diplomatic allies in recent years. And so there is a danger, I think, a threat to Taiwan's autonomy. The United States has an interest in having the people on the two sides of the strait work out their differences peacefully. And the people of Taiwan right now, as I said, really just don't want to be part of the People's Republic of China.
Well, we remember the controversy after then-President-elect Trump spoke on the phone with the leader of Taiwan after he was elected. This was a break from U.S. policy. Has Trump's election changed the situation at all between China and Taiwan, do you think?
Well, I think it has, particularly that phone call. I think it raised concerns in Taiwan that the President Trump might actually do something that would be very forward-leaning in Taiwan that might provoke an attack from Beijing. But of course, it raised even more alarm in Beijing that maybe Trump would somehow establish diplomatic ties or break from other precedents in policy toward Taiwan. So it really raised concerns on both sides of the strait, though there were, of course, people in Taiwan that saw it as a wonderful opportunity. But I think the remaining fear, as we are now several years in the aftermath of that phone call, is that maybe President Trump would use Taiwan as a bargaining chip, that he might actually throw Taiwan under the bus in order to get something from Xi Jinping, maybe in a trade deal. And I think that concern still permeates a lot of people in Taiwan.
And how does the rest of the region feel about this? You're just back from a trip to Singapore. Is the tension between China and Taiwan playing out in other countries in the region?
Well, people in the region are certainly concerned about the possibility of China using economic coercion against its neighbors, and Taiwan being just one of them. We've seen China use economic coercion against countries like South Korea for deploying a missile defense system, or the Philippines for taking a case in the South China Sea against China. So they're worried about that. They are worried about any potential use of military force. The people of the region see that China is rising in a way that brings them economic benefits, but also potentially that China wants to have its way, ensure its interests are protected at the expense of the interests of other countries in the region. And so what Beijing does against Taiwan, how it deals with its differences, may say something about how China might deal with some of its differences with Southeast Asian countries that have disputes over the South China Sea, or maybe even with Japan over the East China Sea.
That is Bonnie Glaser, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, Broadway musical legend Carol Channing is gone. Hard to believe. She seemed infinite. She was 97, and we fully expected to see her mount the stage again as she had for years to reprise her Tony-winning role as Dolly Levi in 1964's Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louie. It's so nice to be back home where I belong.
Carol Channing was born in Seattle in 1921. In 1949, she got her first big break on Broadway as Lorelei Lee in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, owning Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. but square cut or pear shape. These rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
In 1995, Carol Channing recalled getting that part from playwright Anita Loos.
She said, Lorelei Lee can be played by two ways. One, by the prettiest, cutest, littlest girl in town, or by a comedian's comedy comment on the prettiest, cutest, littlest girl in town. And that's how I got the part. And I'll forever be grateful to her. She's my spiritual mother.
Carol Channing also appeared in films. She played Muzzy Van Hosmer in Thoroughly Modern Millie in 1967.
Everything today is thoroughly modern. Check your personality. Everything today makes yesterday slow. Better face reality. It's not insanity, says Vanity Fair. In fact, it's stylish to raise your skirts and bob your hair.
While stars are tweeting out their applause, Bernadette Peters says Channing was show business and love personified. George Takei calls her one of Broadway's greatest lights. Sandra Bernhard says she changed my DNA. Lin-Manuel Miranda tweeted the lyrics to Before the Parade Passes By. I'm going to raise the roof. I'm going to carry on. Others just simply say, goodbye, Dolly. Again, Carol Channing died early this morning at her home in California. She was 97.
I'm going to raise the roof. I'm going to carry on. Give me an old trombone. Give me an old baton. Before the parade passes by.
You're listening to Here and Now. Pre-K and kindergarten teachers have a lot to do, teaching early literacy, numbers, interpersonal skills, and in some states, changing diapers. Now, while the majority of school-aged kids are toilet trained by the time they get to preschool at around 4, many kids aren't, and many school districts can't legally refuse them and their diapers. That's being debated now in Buffalo, New York, where teachers say the number of non-toilet trained students in their classrooms is climbing, and it's stretching teachers and their aides thin and stigmatizing the kids. Phil Rumor is president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation. He joins us from Buffalo. Phil, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're good. So you are raising this as a concern for the teachers union in Buffalo. What's the genesis of this?
Well, the genesis came from an increase in the number of students that are coming to school that haven't been toilet trained or potty trained. And there is no policy in place or procedure in place to work with the child to either potty train them, to clean them when they have an accident, et cetera. Because the teacher can't do it because it takes away from the class. The teacher aides here say that it's not their responsibility. So what we have then is a student that's actually then, and we have about 43 of them in Buffalo, mostly in kindergarten and pre-K, that are actually being embarrassed, stigmatized, teased by their peers.
Well, let's rush to say, you are not blaming the kids. You're concerned about the kids.
Yeah, I'm not blaming the parents either, because in some cases we have an autistic child or we have a child with emotional problems or physical problems.
Yeah. You say there's no policy, but there are laws in many states. So in Buffalo, can a school district refuse a child who's still wearing diapers?
We have been informed by the district that it is not allowed under state law to refuse a child who has not been toilet trained or potty trained.
But you are also concerned that, I mean, this is such a sensitive topic. If it's not handled correctly, I imagine a child can feel terrible.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to focus on the child and how we can help the child and the parents to help potty train the child. Because let's face it, whenever the child has an accident or in class, the rest of the kids will tease the child. The child is stigmatized. The number one concern should be that child, and how do we get that child potty trained so that they are no longer stigmatized and they can function.
Well, and you said there's at least 43 in the school district. This was from your survey, because it sounds like the district thought there were fewer children, and in the past there had been.
Now, the district told the Board of Education that there were only about 6 or 8 students in the district. When we heard that, we knew that that wasn't correct. And this is one of the reasons that we did the study. And this was only a one-week study. I'm sure there are more than 43.
Yeah.
Most of it is concentrated in kindergarten and pre-K. However, we have some students that are 5, 6, and 7 years old that are having a similar issue.
In addition to finding out how many kids there were in your survey, you also got comments from teachers. Here's one who teaches in a special education classroom. They write, "I have had 2 assistants quit for not wanting to change soiled pull-ups. I'm on my 4th assistant. She's choosing to not change students. I've been doing it as a teacher because if not, my room would just smell." Another teacher writes, "Sometimes the child is such a mess that he or she must go home to be showered." Another writes of a student, "Not only did she not want to use the toilet, she would go in her pants and not say a word." Another writes, "I set an alarm on my phone to toilet train a student to go try every hour last year. She finally was trained." And that's the point. Other teachers say in these comments that you collected, you know, toilet training, anyone who's done it, it's a 24/7 job. And teachers don't have the time to do that, although this one said she set her alarm to do it.
That's why it's absolutely critical to have somebody that's trained to help and to work with the parents. Because once again, you have to focus on what's the best for the child. And what's best for the child is that everybody has to be together. We have to find a way of working with the parents to do this, because, as you correctly point out, this isn't something like math that you can teach your number facts in school.
So what are you asking for? Do you think there should be special aides? I heard from teachers here saying their teaching aides didn't want to do this. Do you think there should be something like a special, it almost sounds like a health aide there just to potty train the kids? I mean, what do you think there needs to be?
Obviously, it can't be the teacher, because the teacher can't leave the classroom. So what there has to be is a special health care aide. Every school should identify 1 or 2 teacher aides who want to do it, who are then trained how to work with the parents and how to toilet train a child, and who also have the requisite immunizations to take care of it. There should be a policy that everybody knows. They really should be paid extra, too, because it's something that I think is beyond the job title of anybody to do it. And there should always be 2 people present. There aren't appropriate materials that are there. There are no pull-ups for the students. You also have to have the facilities and also the supplies that you need for the children. It's something that should have been done many years ago, and it has to be done now because it seems to be getting to be more of a problem.
Phil Rumor, president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation. Phil, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
You take care.
Okay, sometimes it's the little things. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.